thank you all for coming and giving up your Sunday afternoon, and sorry about the delay to start with. We have now got going, and I was very keen that you should see the slides, both for text and for image. Now, I have given, I don't know if anyone recognises the title, but I have given it Tennyson's title. Tennyson's Ulysses gives us the line, beyond the utmost bounds of human thought, and I think that this is what Dante is, in a way, presenting to us. And the three lines that are very, very famous and quoted by everybody, every school child in Italy, and you see them again and again, are these three. Considerate la vostra semenza, fatti non fosti a viver come bruti, ma per seguir virtute e conoscenza. And I should acknowledge Richard Lansing's translation, which I have used for my text. Now, they're very often quoted, these lines, and they are taken, rightly, as emblematic of the ideal of the actual Commedia. They're very direct, they're very simple. In today's Italian, we would say the same thing in exactly the same way. We might say conoscenza rather than conoscenza, but the difference is negligible. And they are an appropriate emblem, actually, for a work that its author wants us to believe belongs to the sphere of ethics. It was doctrinalis, it was doctrinal, and he states that very firmly in the last canto of the Commedia, that he wrote for the greater glory of God, but also for future generations of ordinary people. And it's our ordinariness that matters, because Dante, and this is very unusual for a man of his standing and his learning, in the year 1300, he writes in the vernacular. He does not write in Latin. And he tells us very directly why he does not write in Latin, because he said Latin was a setting sun, and a new sun was rising, a new sun that would give light to those in darkness. Now, those in darkness were those who could not read Latin. And he says in the Convivio that there were very many, there were molti e molte, men and women, very many of both kinds, and they were the people to whom, for whom he was writing, to whom he was speaking. Now, the work that we're, where these three lines are, a huge work where this tercet is called the Commedia. Centuries later, a printer tagged on the word divine, but it's not within Dante's text, so Dantists call it the comedy, the Commedia. What does he mean by comedy? It is very, very simple. Well, I know books have been written on just that, but for Dante, basically, it is a beginning in very adverse conditions, but a happy ending. There's also another side. Stylistically, he says, a comedy is not in high style. It is lowly, it is ordinary. And that's what he believes his work to be. Now, the 100 canti begin appropriately in very great darkness. We have the darkness where the pilgrim, Dante as pilgrim, also Dante poet, is finding himself in a very, very dark and forbidding wood. And he's anguished. Now, it is very important not to believe ever, ever that Dante is lost. Commonly, I'm afraid, translators do speak of Dante as lost. It's not the word he uses. The word lost in Italian is perduto, and Dante uses perduto for the damned. They are really lost. They are the perduta gente, but certainly not Dante himself. In fact, in Paradise, at his exam on hope, his three exams, faith, hope and charity, and at the exam on hope he's told he is the best hoper ever that there could be. So, you know, the whole notion of hope for the Christian is absolutely fundamental. So now he begins in the first canto in huge darkness, and where do we end? With l'amor che muove il sole e le altre stelle. We end 100 canti later in the whole wonder of creation that emanates from the love of God, and that creation is light, absolute light. Dante actually speaks of his work in Paradiso, of his Commedia, when he's coming to the end of it, as a consecrated poem. And then later he will say it is a poema sacro, al quale ha posto mano e cielo e terra. In other words, a four-handed job written by both heaven and by himself on earth. Clive James actually says very simply, as Dante does, to which heaven and earth have set their hand. Now, there are several indications that he wants us to believe that this is a book of Revelation. This happens again and again in the Commedia, and I'm just giving you one brief example of it. Towards the end of Purgatorio, Beatrice, who has severely reprimanded him for all his sinning, but now he is cleansed, and she gives him the message. Però in pro del mondo che malvive, al carro tieni or gli occhi, e quel che vedi ritornato di là fa che tu scrive. You know, everything you've seen, once you go back down, fa che tu scrive. Make sure that you write it. And there are several links with Revelation, but this is a particularly strong one in that fa che tu scrive. It's the quod vides scrive in libro, the voice speaking to John. And so the purpose of this book is to ensure that we do not go astray, because we are going astray, but we have to learn from this, and we must not do so. Now, I'm giving you what are not really very clear, not even if you were near, they're not very clear, but they give you the sense of the three regni d'oltretomba, the three regions beyond the grave. And you will see here the selva oscura, the dark wood, and this is the descent down into hell to where Lucifer is at the very, very bottom. And then the poets arrive at the southern hemisphere, and there is the mountain which they will climb. And at a certain point, Virgil, symbol of reason and symbol of Dante's conscience, vanishes, and Dante finally makes his own entrance, moving but not really moving, into paradise, where he will finally have the vision of God. Now, the prime mover in the Commedia, at the level of the story, the prime mover of the pilgrim's journey is Mary. The Virgin Mary, to whom Dante says he has prayed always e mane e sera, morning and evening, and she is the one who, aware of him in the darkness of the wood, that is in a state of turmoil, in a state of anguish, at various levels, she is the one who sends supernatural aid in order to help him on this journey. Dante is both the author, as I have said, but he's also the protagonist. And as protagonist of the journey, as pilgrim, he represents all of us. In fact, in the very first line, he says, nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita, nostra. We are all in it with him. It's not Dante on his own, it's Dante with us. And what you have then in hell is terrible physical punishment, but also psychological punishment. I stress it because most people tell you there is no psychological punishment in Dante's hell, but that's not so at all. And what you have then in purgatory is purifying. It is not penal. The whole punishment of purgatory is a purifying one. And just as the souls go into hell very willingly, the souls do not go into hell by being pushed there by the devils. No, they are punished once within. But Dante tells us that the damned go very willingly into hell, and gives us a lovely autumnal image, and I always teach this at the beginning of autumn, and we can see it in the trees, the leaves falling. Come d'autunno si levan le foglie. A lovely simile that Milton has taken up, thick as autumnal leaves that strew the brooks in Vallombrosa. So you have the souls all very willing to cross the Acheron into hell. And the sense of willingness is there all the time. In Paradiso it is stressed that God's greatest gift to man is this gift of choice, the libero arbitrio. The souls go willingly into hell because they have chosen it. They have not been talked into it by anybody else. Sin is a choice, you give your full consent. And equally, the purifying is a choice, and you move into paradise when within you, you know that you have purified yourself of your wrongdoing. And equally, when you're in heaven, you're in God's love immediately, although Dante explains to us that he has to tell us sequentially, bit by bit by bit, heaven by heaven, because otherwise we would not be able to follow him. Understand him is not the word I would use. Understand doesn't come, it's a bit beyond understanding, but the important thing is empathy, and that we move with him. And the whole notion of the universe is given beautifully by Dante, because once up there, he can see our cosmos as he imagines it. And he gives an image that is very much, I think, a scholar's one, that the universe he sees is like all the loose leaves of a book. Remember, medieval times, the year 1300, they were not e-books as we are now using. And he sees these loose leaves of a book, squadernato, but yet legato con amore, sort of tied together by into the love of God. And love is the word of the Commedia. That amore that we have at the very beginning and that we have at the very end. It's a love that is a fusion of intellect and passion. And Dante speaks of this in relation to himself as la mente innamorata, the mind in love. And I think we synchronize intuitively with this harmony of peace and of love, although theologically it is, of course, a huge challenge. Dante himself admits that his own words are inadequate, and he speaks of his vision as an outrage, an excess. And I think, well, there are several links with Bonaventure, and this is one of many, that it's the excessus mentis of the mystics and of Bonaventure in particular. It's the mind going beyond itself and memory failing to recall anything but the emotion of the ecstasy, the very strong passion that the vision has left. And always in the Commedia, he links to our experience, otherwise we wouldn't be with him. He links to our experience, and he says it's just as when we waken from a dream. The details have vanished, but the emotion of that dream is still aroused in us. And that emotion is what he captures. And what the similes really serve to do, ultimately, is to make the incomprehensible acceptable. They don't make it understandable, but they make it acceptable. Now, he writes in poetry. He had begun a work in prose, a philosophical one, like the Commedia, ethically oriented, but it was in prose. But he decided that poetry was really what made a greatest impact on people, and of course poetry is mnemonic, much easier to remember and memorize than prose. He speaks of poetry as being writing fashioned in harmonious unity, mosaico armonizzata, legame mosaico armonizzata. And he says that if you translate it in any way, you shatter all its dolcezza e armonia, all its sweetness, all its harmony. Now, for many years I never translated because Dante had said not to, that I would be shattering everything. In fact, I think it's a bit extremist, his position. I think you do lose in translation. You certainly do lose, and that's the word. But you also are retaining quite a bit, and it's important because translation is vital. It is the door that opens out to make that light shine towards other people, and I think it's very important for us, so we mustn't be superior about it. Now, it's about the poetry I really want to speak to you, but I wanted to give you first these general ideas. Another one that is important is one that again comes from Dante. Everything I say really has a foundation in Dante's own work, and that is that his work is polysemous, that everything is multi-layered with meaning. He addresses us, you know, 16 times through the Commedia, warning us it's not easy, warning us that we're not to take it at face value, but we're to look underneath and see greater depth than may at first be apparent. And that's what I want to do with the episode of Ulysses. I want to show you how, I won't fully succeed, but give you an idea of how he captures our imagination, and then how deceived we can be if we're not really, really alert. So we're going back to the beginning, and I'm giving you a different translation for that. Considerate la vostra semenza. Well, you see, virtute is a problematical word. Conoscenza, fair enough, that's knowledge. But virtute is a sort of excellence. I think Mackenzie gets it very right in that. Virtute comes, of course, from the Latin vir. It's what makes us human beings. And for Dante, what makes us human beings is our intelligence. It's that mente innamorata, it's our intelligence and our feeling combined. And that seguir virtute does not mean strictly moral virtues. It really means the following of what really makes us human and what is greatest in us, represented by our humanity. Now, they are part of the words of Ulysses to his men. Dante does not see Ulysses because the damnati, the damned, are enclosed in tongues of fire. And I want to show you this map, which was done years ago by the architect husband of the woman who first taught me Dante, of hell. And it's a very, very clear, simple one. And you have here the selva oscura, and there is your porta, there is your gateway in. And I hope you can see in continenti and continenti, in other words, your whole first half of hell has to do with those who could not control their emotions, those whose reason was simply not able to impose itself on their behavior, and therefore they behaved lustfully, they behaved sensually, they behaved violently. All of that is much less heinous in the eyes of Dante. Now, they're all suffering, you know, all hell is hell. But having said that, they're not quite as bad and rejected in fierce punishment as these other ones are, because with this lower part you have the deceivers, you have the fraudulent, and I'm not going to try and show you the fullness of it somehow, and it's not quite showing up here, but I'm not going to try and fiddle with it. At the very bottom there's Lucifer, and there you have the traitors. Now, what is the big difference? They have misused their intelligence, the others have not. The others have not allowed their intelligence to control emotion, but these people have actually, these damnati in the lower part, have actually used their intelligence, but used it to deceive others. And that sense of the deception and above all betrayal, I mean, away down in one of the mouths of Lucifer, of course he's got to have three, reversal of the Trinity, in one of his mouths there is of course Judas, the arch traitor. Now, I want to give you what Dante sees in the eighth bulge of the eighth circle of the traitors. Now, not the betrayers, but the traitors. And what he does not see people, what he sees is tongues of fire. I hope that gives you an idea there. They're all flames with a little point at the top. And those are Dante and Virgil. Botticelli shows them stage by stage by stage. Botticelli was doing this about 1480. And those are the tongues of fire. And inside are, in one of them, because it's got two peaks, in one of them there are two damnati, Ulysses and Diomedes. Now, Dante's punishments are always related through the contrapassum to the crime. Their crime was to hide their real self, to hide their real mental intention from others, to show something different from what they were within. And therefore, they cannot here be seen as such. How did they deceive others? How did they fraudulently counsel other people? Through their words, the use of the tongue. And this, of course, is a reversal of the Pentecostal idea of the Holy Spirit descending as tongues of fire on the heads of the apostles. So this is a bit the background to the particular imagery. I'm going to show you Blake, because Blake there gives you a better idea of, well, a different idea of the two peaks of the one flame, and there are Ulysses and Diomedes within it. And then I'm going to show you yet another picture in a moment when I've said a little bit more of someone who I think has got the idea in a very clear way. Now, we've said that in the division we have, first of all, since sensuality, violence, and then we come to deception. What is the deception of Ulysses? What does the text actually tell us? It mentions three specific occasions, right? Three occasions. And they are the wooden horse at Troy, They are the luring of Achilles into war, and they are the theft of the Palladium. All three are mentioned by Dante, and these he would have got from his Latin sources. He would have got them from Statius, primarily the Accolade, and then also Virgil, Horace, Ovid, and Cicero. But then he gives us something different. He gives us a voyage of Ulysses, the homebound hero who sets out on a new journey, and this very likely is Metamorphoses 14, 4, 8, where there is a hint of Ulysses having gone out again from his return home and not returning ever to tell that last voyage. And so Dante is going to be the one to tell it. Now, it should be said that the Greeks did not have a good press in medieval times. The Greeks were deceitful and untrustworthy. The hero of Dante is, of course, Aeneas. And Aeneas was the founder of the city of Rome for Dante, where Christ was registered as a Roman citizen. That will be said that of the heavenly city, of questa Roma onde Cristo è Romano, the Romanitas of the sacred city and of the heavenly city is fundamental for Dante. And Aeneas, as the founder of that city, is always remembered by Dante as being pious, that is, with proper respect for the gods. The pietas of Aeneas is the respect for the sources of his being, and they were his father, his fatherland, his gods. They are the basic pietas that permeates the Commedia every time that we meet the word. That is the connotation. Now, Virgil is Dante's authority. He will speak of Virgil as his auctoritas, il mio maestro, il mio autore. And what was Ulysses for Virgil? He was the fandi fictor Ulysses, the creator of deceit in Aeneid 9. The frauds of sly Ulysses, as Dryden translates it. So what Dante is doing, he's weaving a story around a well-known deceiver. People would have expected, in listening to this, and the Commedia was read out from the pulpit in churches from not very long after Dante died, they would have expected a story of deception where Ulysses was concerned. And before we look at the text, remember another little point about the dannati. They never say, I am here through my own fault, my own most grievous fault. They rewrite their story. They present themselves as innocent, as heroic. They may have followed false images of good, as Dante will say in Purgatorio, immagini di ben seguendo false. There's a lot of Paul in Dante, I should add. But nonetheless, they should have known better. Now, what I will read at the end is his speech to his men, but we will look at it now through pictures and text. I'm going to give you this picture next. Now, that is one I'm very fond of because I haven't looked at all, but it's the only one that gives you a nasty Ulysses. It was done by Bartolomeo di Frosino about 1420. It's in a manuscript in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris. And what I think is relevant there is the very fierce face that Ulysses has. In other words, whoever read that version of the Commedia will have seen at once that he is a baddie. And I think it's worth having it there because, of course, the romantic critics make of Ulysses a goodie. And a lot of people read that canto feeling, well, poor Dante, she didn't really mean to put him there, but he sort of had to toe the line or something. As if Dante towed any lines, he never did. He was very, very much himself. And, well, we have to ask, why is he damned? It's not a question that for a long, long time was ever asked about Ulysses, and not everybody will agree on the answer. I'll tell you how I read the text. But what Bartolomeo definitely got right there was the look on that face that immediately it tells you this is a baddie. Now, next, This is, I hope everybody can see that text, and anyway you do have a translation yourselves. I'm going to take you through it, explaining it, and finally then I shall read it in Italian. I like to read it at the very end when you have an idea of what it is that I am reading and you have a better understanding of it. Now, it really begins with Virgil, O voi, Virgil addressing Ulysses and Diomedes. Why Virgil? Because Virgil says to Dante, leave them to me. You know, they may not quite like the idea of you addressing them. In other words, the snobbery, the superiority of the Greeks. At least Virgil was, you know, in terms of classical writings, not on their level, but nonetheless better than this new upstart Dante. So, and very interestingly, what our Ulysses does in answering him, well, Virgil wants to know what's happened to them, how, you know, when you, because Virgil refers to his own writing, and tell me what happened, where perduto a morir chissi. And that perduto immediately tells you that there was some transgression on his part. Where you were lost and where did you die? In other words, Virgil knows that it was not back home with his family and his own community that Ulysses died. Now, you have the answer coming with difficulty, as you see there around 85, 86. He answers with difficulty. Why? Because this is the opposite of life. He had a mellifluous way of speaking, of convincing people, and easy words, and now it's very, very different because, of course, he's being punished precisely in that very thing in which he excelled in his life. But as Virgil has been polite, so is Ulysses back. And how does he begin? If you look there at line 90, you are seeing that he begins with, well, I suppose we would call it a captatio benevolentiae. In other words, he remembers Virgil, and where Virgil wrote, and of a very ignominious year in the life of himself and his men, when they were subject to the spell of Circe. And he remembers Gaeta, and what does he say about Gaeta? That it was renamed by Aeneas. Now, that is not just a casual reference. It's in Virgil. It's where the fictitious character Ulysses has got it. But the point is that it was in Gaeta that Aeneas, the pious Aeneas, buried his nurse and gave the name to the locality, but also that the funeral rites for her were all followed. That means really that it was an act of pietas, and that's not what our Ulysses is into at all. Ulysses is moving in a very different way, in a very different way. Now, in the very next bit of text, you will see the denial of the pietas, because there are three negatives, ne, ne, ne. What does Ulysses say? He is denying precisely what he should have done. In other words, he had a duty to his son, and his son should have kept him at home. He had a duty to his old father, the vecchio padre, but he didn't stay at home. He had a duty of love to his wife, debito amore, lo qual dovea Penelope far lieta, but he doesn't stay at home. Out he goes. He rejects all these duties. Our father, our fatherland, our gods, he rejects all of this and he sets out on this wide expanse. It's a fabulous story when you carry on and you see that there is this ardore, this zeal moving him. Of course, the ardore is a major problem in the Commedia because the condemnation from Canto 1 represented by the wolf of greed, to the very, very last words that Beatrice condemns, and they are the mala cupidigia, and Clement and Boniface and so on, who had indulged in it at the expense of the spiritual leadership that they should have given the church. It is greed that is being condemned. It is the cupidigia, the cupiditas, right through. And the opposite of cupidigia is justitia. In the monarchy, Dante has these two great big pillars, justice and greed. And I don't have to explain any further. It is greed that ruins justice in our society so that all of society suffers. And we all know this. We have, all of us, lived through it in the last few years. And this is what Dante is condemning right through. Now, desire is good. In fact, he speaks of desire and indeed ardore of a moto spirituale. It is a motivator, a basic motivator in things that are spiritual, things that are intellectual. But it's the excess. That's what greed is, just the excess. Now, Cicero has written on Virgil, and calls him, in fact, greedy for knowledge. But in Roman times, the cupiditas is not, it can be good, it can be bad. It is a great knowledge, it's not excess of. And whereas for Dante, it is the uncontrolled, the never to be satisfied craving, the wanting more and more and more. Petrarch simply says of Ulysses, he wanted to see too much, in plain language. Now, so let's get back to the poetry. It's, look at that line, misi me per l'alto mare aperto. You have that ma, misi me, mare. You have this huge sense of an expanse of sea and just him out there all on his own with a small boat and an even smaller crew of men. But the proud leader, non fui deserto, not one of them ever deserted me. So he has this huge sense of their loyalty. In other words, he has them in his hands and is responsible for them. And they come, and they come through the Mediterranean, and you have Spain, you have North Africa, you have, well, Sardinia and Spain and North Africa, and finally, and he is remembering, at this stage of life, we'd been navigators all our lives. We were vecchi e tardi. And I know just exactly what he means. We were old and we had slowed down. And that's true. At a certain point, it's what happens to you. And where do they come? To the Pillars of Hercules. And that is the Strait of Gibraltar. Now, the Pillars of Hercules, the Strait of Gibraltar, of course, there's an Edenic connection here. What Dante is doing all the time is bringing together the two great cultural influences and shapers of us, European tradition. And those are the Greco-Roman and the Judeo-Christian. And he's always blending them. The very first word that he utters in the Commedia in Canto 1, when he's very, very frightened and thinks he has to go back into the darkness and the fear that and the horror that he's come from, is miserere. Yes, miserere is a psalm. It's the penitential psalm. So he is begging at once his God for mercy. But equally, Aeneas had used it in not too dissimilar circumstances. So there is, from the very, very beginning, this bringing together of two cultures and the going beyond the columns of Hercules, the awareness that they have, that man should not go beyond, that man should not go beyond, is very present in Ulysses, and that's when he makes his speech. So we have, to some extent, as I say, Adam and Eden in the background there, and I'll tell you more about that in a minute. Now, he addresses his men, and how does he address them? He addresses them as frati, as brothers. He puts himself on a level with them, boosts morale. Oh, we've done 100 miglia perigli, all of us together, and we've made it, we've made it, we've got here. And we're at the very end of our lives, the piccola vigilia of our life. That's all, del rimanente, there's not much ahead of us. So you must not deny what we can now go and find, and we shall find it beyond the sun. We shall find it where there are no people. And then immediately he puts the ideal there. Considerate la vostra semenza. And the men are completely taken with it. This is great. We are going to find virtute, conoscenza. This is very noble. This is ideal. And this is very right. And they dart away. Li miei compagni feci io si aguti. They're just full of wanting, of enthusiasm, of wanting to go with just a few words. Orazione picciola. Only a few words to convince them. And he's done it. He's achieved it. And off they go. And how does Dante describe their great navigation beyond Gibraltar into the Atlantic, he describes it as a folle volo. Folle is foolish, same etymology, but we use it very casually nowadays, not for Dante. For Dante, folle is really, really letting go of your reason, losing all control, and doing something that is a denial of your very manliness, of what makes you the human being, the abandoning of reason. Now, Adam is going to say the same of what he did in Eden, because Adam comes in Canto 26 of Paradiso. The Commedia is full of these links, of these parallels and interconnections. And it's not for nothing, I think, that Adam is in 26 of Paradiso, like Ulysses in 26 of Hell. And Adam speaks of his own violation of the law that he had been given as follia, as having done something very, very wrong and having lost the control by his reason. Now, let us see the end of the journey. And so they go, and it's all night, it's the stars, it's all the moon. It's five times the moon, there is a full moon to enable them to see further. It's all a sense of darkness. And finally, they see a dark mountain, again an ocean of darkness, away in the distance. And they'd never seen anything as high as that. And so there is the sense of expectation. This is land. And you can imagine, I mean, we know how many attempted this navigation beyond into the Atlantic. The time of Dante, nobody had got there. We're talking really 200 years before either Vasco da Gama or before Columbus. So many lost their lives. In Dante's time, this story would have seen something that happened so often and in the memory of everybody. They see this mountain and the joy, ci allegrammo, great, there's land at last. But then the turbulence, il turbo nacque, this great big whirl wave comes and quickly, quickly destroys them. Of course, triple, it will toss the boat, the men, Ulysses, three times, has to be three in the Commedia, three times before it finally sinks on the fourth. Come altrui piacque, as pleased another. And I want to show you T.S. Eliot. This is in a discarded part of the wasteland. Pound didn't like it and got him to remove all this section. But this section, in fact, was where Dante's Ulysses story is told and interpreted in Eliot's manner. And I love the particular lines in it. And if another knows, I know not, who only know that there is no more noise now, which is just how Dante ends his story, in that quietude. Everything is calm again. It is all over, and they have drowned. Now, as I hope in a few minutes now, when I read it to you properly in Italian, I hope you'll see how that poetry is wonderful and how it captures us and how we go with it. But we've got to stop for a moment now and say, why is this man damned? It's a hypnotic effect we've had, but why? And I think it's simple. I'm going to give you an answer from Shakespeare. The devil can cite scripture for his purpose. An evil soul producing holy witness is like a villain with a smiling cheek, a goodly apple rotten at the heart. Oh, what a goodly outside falsehood hath. So Ulysses cannot be a hero. He's in hell. And we have got carried away with the story. But what is wrong? He's not just a deceiver three times over. He is also a deceiver a fourth time. And this is where he really deceives them. They are to go beyond the sun to the world without people. Beyond the sun. Dante more than once speaks of the sun as God, because God is enlightenment, God is light, and tenebrae are to be feared, because tenebrae is where evil is, and it is the work, the world of the darkness, where knowledge cannot be. He speaks of hell as a place where you cannot acquire knowledge because the mind has ceased to be enlightened. So when Ulysses is putting it to his men that they have to go directo al sol, he's actually inviting them to go into the kingdom of evil, to go into the kingdom where there will be absolutely no guidance. And beyond that, he's saying, go to the world where there aren't any people. Now Dante, in Convivio, in the Commedia, makes it very clear that man is an animale civile, animale compagnevole, companionable, must live with other human beings. We belong to a society. Remember that basic pietas, our father, our fatherland, that's our community. We're social beings, we have to give. We are not made to live alone. And we have a duty to contribute to that society. God is love, and from that love he has created the universe. This is how Dante sees it, that l'amor che muove il sole e l'altre stelle. And through the love of God, the creation is still creating. And we humans have been created to share ultimately in that love of God, but we share in it on earth through service of neighbor. And that is how Dante, I think, puts it all together. What we do has consequences, and it's the consequences to others above all that we have to answer for. Ulysses convinces his men of a great ideal, the most worthy one that we can have, but he discards the fundamentals of existence, that we need an enlightenment of the superior being, our God, and we need the society to which we belong and for which we have to act. Otherwise, we shall be lost. Now, artistically and ethically, it is important for Dante to engage us with the damned as human beings. We would never, never read through 33 of Damnation if they were all awful, like Filippo Argenti. There are two horrible, horrible ones in hell that we really have to say, oh my goodness, that's evil. We don't want anything to do with him. And one is Filippo Argenti. And I just give you what I think is fundamental, when Dante says about him, questi al mondo fu persona orgogliosa. Bontà non è che sua memoria fregi. You can't say a word of good about him. Not a word of good. Of all the others, we have to say good, otherwise we wouldn't read about them. And I think that Dante's purpose is really to get us engaging with them, but to keep us sharp on what is it that has gone wrong. Because Ulysses is not the only character who's been much misunderstood. The dramatis personae in the three-act comedy are exemplar. They're all there for us to learn from them. They represent human beings with a potential for good that often they actualized, but then ruined by having erred very seriously. And Dante engages us mainly with people from his own society. Ulysses belongs to a small minority. And what does Dante do in the canto after Ulysses? He creates the figure of Guido da Montefeltro, who was only 2 years dead in 1300, and an interaction between Guido and Boniface VIII, which is also an indictment of Boniface, but that would be a whole other lecture. But what I'm trying to get across to you is that he is giving us exemplary characters on the basis of noblesse oblige. In other words, of those to whom much has been given, of them much will be demanded. And people like Guido, like Ulysses, people of great intelligence, people who had great qualities of leadership, were ones who should have led better and not led people to their ruin, which is what happens here. So our pursuit of knowledge must have ethical boundaries, and it should be within the context of other people. And this is what I think is being very much enacted in this particular canto. Now, we've talked about it for about 700 years, and it's been still discussed. And I want to give a little quotation before I read it from a very wonderful colleague we had, now gone to his reward, W.B. Stanford, who wrote a book on the figure of Ulysses in Western literature. And he says that despite its brevity, it's a very short few terzine, despite its brevity, this is the most influential in the whole evolution of the wandering hero. And yes, he has been interpreted and reinterpreted in very many, many ways. And I give you Tennyson. I won't read it because I want to read the poetry and I don't want to delay too long. But if you even just look at those last lines, the way Tennyson has interpreted Ulysses, a sense of, you know, we're not now that strength which in old days moved heaven and earth. That which we are one equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. It's your Miltonic, awake, arise, or be forever fallen. But it's not the last word. It's another interpretation of what Dante has said, and perhaps we continue to interpret and to discuss. Because the Commedia is a classic, the way Calvino defines classics, a book that has never finished what it wants to say. Now, we are going to go back to the text in Italian, and I will read just the speech now. I won't read, I'll begin with the Bratti, because I think it's quite late for you. No, I won't begin with the Frati. Sorry, I want to begin really with the beginning of the whole speech. Yeah, Ne dolcezza, sorry about that. Yes, I won't begin with Virgil, those few lines of Virgil, but I'll take it up at 85 when Ulisse starts to answer. Right, is everyone with me? Yeah, or you have it in your text anyway. Lo maggior corno della fiamma antica cominciò a crollarsi mormorando, pur come quella cui vento affatica. Indi la cima qua e là menando, come fosse la lingua che parlasse, gittò voce di fuori e disse: quando mi dipartì da Circe, che sottrasse me più d'un anno l'appresso a Gaeta, prima che sì Enea la nomasse, né dolcezza di figlio, né la pietà del vecchio padre, né il debito amore, lo qual dove Penelope far lieta, vincer poter dentro a me l'ardore, ch'io ebbi a divenir del mondo esperto e degli vizi umani e del valore. Ma misi me per l'alto mare aperto, sol con un legno e con quella compagna picciola dalla qual non fui diserto. L'un lito e l'altro vidi infin la Spagna, fin nel Morocco e l'isola dei Sardi, e l'altre che quel mare intorno bagna. Io e compagni eravam vecchi e tardi, quando venimmo a quella foce stretta, dove Ercole segnò li suoi riguardi, a ciò che l'uom più oltre non si metta. Dalla man destra mi lasciai Siviglia, dall'altra già m'avea lasciata setta. O frati, dissi, che per 100 miglia perigli siete giunti all'Occidente, a questa tanto picciola Virgilia dei nostri sensi che è del rimanente, non vogliate negar l'esperienza di retro al sol nel mondo senza gente. Considerate la vostra semenza, fatti, non foste a viver come bruti, ma per seguir virtute e conoscenza. I miei compagni feci'io sì avuti con questa razion picciola, al cammino ch'appena poscia li avrei ritenuti, e volta nostra poppa nel mattino dei remi face mali al folle volo, sempre acquistando dal lato mancino. Tutte le stelle già l'altro polo vedea la notte, e il nostro tanto basso che non sorgea fuor del marinsuolo, 5 volte era acceso e tante casso lo lume era di sotto dalla luna, poiché entrati eravamo nell'alto passo. quando n'apparve una montagna bruna per la distanza e parvemi alta tanto quanto veduta non avea alcuna. Noi ci allegrammo e tosto tornò in pianto che della nuova terra un turbo nacque e percosse del legno il primo canto. Tre volte il fe girar con tutte l'acque, alla quarta levar la poppa in suso e la prora ire in giù, come altrui piacque, infin che il mar fu sovra noi richiuso. Thank you for listening.